trusted voice of truth and light.
God gave me a gift. I shovel well. I shovel very well.
And a rally point for those who've accepted the reality that they are not sheep.
We've got a blind date with destiny.
And it looks like she's ordered the lobster.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Well, hello there and welcome to the show. Every day, I have the honor, the privilege of sitting behind this microphone, delivering precision-guided truth bombs to those who are looking for such things, and also carefully disarming dangerous myths intended to separate you from your freedom. I wouldn't say it's exactly thankless work, because actually I get to hear from a lot of people throughout the week. I do appreciate the words of encouragement. I appreciate the support of those who subscribe and get my show notes. And I especially appreciate the sponsors who make this show possible, including MonticelloCollege.org, GovernYourIncome.com, Sewing and Quilting Center in St. George, Utah, HSLAmmo.com, the Heather Turner team at Patriot Home Mortgage and LifesavingFood.com. Well, you know, anytime someone talks about being on the right side of history, your eyes should narrow, and you should listen very closely to what they're saying. I've got a great article here from Frank Ferretti, and this is from SpikedOnline.com, about how there is no right side of history. In fact, too often, people who talk about, well, now you want to be on the right side of history, they're just trying to shut down debate. So Frank Ferretti, writing from the UK, says, in England, it seems you can get away with destroying a public statue if you claim you're on the right side of history. This was the surmise of Liam Walker, QC, who urged a jury to be on the right side of history by acquitting four defendants accused of criminal damage after they toppled the statue of slave trader Edward Colston. Walker's invitation was accepted by the jury, which acquitted the defendants. Now, Frank Ferretti says this shouldn't be a surprise. Today, our political and cultural elites frequently tell us to be on the right side of history. For example, last week, U.S. President Joe Biden told Senate Democrats to get on the right side of history and support his voting rights reforms. Now, the implication is that to not support his policy is to be on the wrong and therefore backward and bigoted side of history. In making such an appeal to the authority of history, Biden was following in the tradition of his Democratic predecessors, Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, who both frequently used the same rhetorical strategy. In fact, Clinton alone referred to the right side of history 21 times during his time in office. Now, actual history, however, has a tendency to make a mockery of those claiming to be on its right side. Frank Ferretti says one of the first uses of the phrase I encountered was in Harold Lasky's Reflections on the Revolutions of Our Time, published in 1943. The pro-Soviet Lasky said the Soviet Union was certainly on the right side of history. Now, number one, given the grim reality of the Soviet Union, Lasky's misplaced faith shows the trajectory of history cannot be second-guessed. Now, today, appealing to the authority of history is just a way of putting a view or policy beyond question. Right? It works by inhibiting and depoliticizing debate. After all, who wants to be on the wrong side of history? But he says it means that one does not have to explain why a particular policy or act is morally righteous, because history, in quotation marks, has already judged it so. So, in 2019, when New Zealand's Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, said her climate change legislation put New Zealand on the right side of history, she conveyed an unspoken warning to her opponents. They not only face the judgment of the electorate if they criticize her policy, they also face the wrath of history. Now, this amounts to a form of guilt-tripping. And he explains, in reality, history does not take sides. It does not work according to a plan or reward or punish those who regard or disregard its message. History, rather, is what people make of it. And because it's a product of human action and interaction, it is open-ended. People may only rarely be able to anticipate the consequences of their actions, but they can still influence and even change the course of events. Now, those who claim to be standing on the right side of history reject this view of human agency. Instead, they effectively endorse the fatalistic belief that the future is foretold, One of the most memorable examples of this view was provided by Nikita Khrushchev, the former leader of the Soviet Union. In a self-consciously provocative speech delivered in November 1956, he warned that whether you like it or not, history is on our side, before telling the Western world, we will bury you. As the collapse of the Soviet Union illustrated, predictions of who's on the right side of history tend to be wildly misguided. Now, the popularity of this phrase among political figures is a recent phenomenon. A search of the LexisNexis newspaper database reveals only one reference to the phrase during the 1970s, when the Reverend Jesse Jackson called on American businesses to stop trading with South Africa and choose to be on the right side of history. And there are only 120 references to it between 1980 and 1990. It's in the 90s that the right side of history references really started taking off. And Frank Ferretti says, today, appeals to the authority of history have acquired a quasi-religious character. Those who claim to be on the right side of history are almost a caricature of the Calvinist idea of the elect, that is, those chosen by God to be saved. However, today's secular elect consists of those who have adopted a woke ethos and mode of behavior. How do we ensure we're on the right side of history? Asks one anxious commentator. Well, luckily, she doesn't have to look far for answers. There's now a veritable army of race trainers and gender experts on hand willing to show people like her what views they need to hold in order to be on the right side of history. In many institutions, rejecting their help is not an option. That's because behind these appeals to the authority of history, there lurks the totalitarian rhetoric of you are either with us or against us. That's a great point. Now, as it happens, those who claim to be on the right side of history are largely indifferent to the legacy of the past. They're neither interested in history nor in any lessons that can legitimately be drawn from it. Those who genuinely wish to participate in the unfolding of history must not be blinded by dogma. They must instead be ready to search for the truth. History provides no guarantees, and that's why we need the freedom to exercise our own judgment through public debate. So Frank Ferretti says, forget trying to be on the right side of history and get on with making it. Now, this brings up kind of an interesting conundrum, and it's probably something you and I have individually faced ourselves. How can you know what history or what historical accounts to trust? I'm so grateful for the time that I got to spend in the company of the great Stephen Pratt. Stephen passed away. Oh, my goodness. It's been almost 10 years since he passed away, but his Know Your Liberty lectures were some of the most instructive time that I spent sharpening my own understanding of history. And Stephen was not one of these guys who, you will listen to every word I say and believe everything. He was a huge stickler for, you need to go and research this for yourself. You need to do your own homework. That's the heuristic approach to learning. But he never asked anybody, take my word for it. One thing he pointed out that has always stuck with me is that, you've heard the maxim, the victors write the history books. It's true. And if you look at the history books that were written according to, you know, if you look at the way history was taught at a specific time in American history, go back 100 years, for instance, versus the way that it's taught today, you're going to see that there's a very noticeable slant, and that's there deliberately. The court historians make sure that whoever is in power at the moment is very favorably reflected, or the recounting of history favors the idea that, yes, and it's right, and therefore it is proper that we should be the ones in charge, and thus it should always be so. Now, look, it's human nature, so I'm not trying to ascribe some, you know, mega evil kind of, you know, motives to what they've done here. But some of the best advice that Stephen Pratt gave me and anyone else who attended his lectures was, if you really want to get a sense of what were people thinking, you've got to read books from the specific time period and letters and correspondence from the time period that you are studying. And keep in mind, they had their blind spots. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind, Aristotle was an absolutely amazing thinker and contributed greatly to the understanding of all of humanity. He also was a guy who believed, you know what, slavery is a natural thing. There are some people who are born to serve, and there are people who are born to be served. And we need those who serve so that the rest of us who, you know, are supposed to be served can think and do things, you know, that don't require using our hands and our backs. Smart guy, but in a pretty big blind spot. And of course, that means you and I probably have blind spots as well. So we need a little bit of humility, and we need to be sure that we're not too full of ourselves, you know, our chronological snobbery, because everybody knows nobody's ever been smarter or better or better dressed or had cooler haircuts than we do. I guess this is a roundabout way of saying don't judge people who came before you too harshly. Chances are they were doing the best they could in the circumstances they were born into. And someone, someday, is going to be looking at you and making similar judgments. How kind would you want them to be to your blind spots and my blind spots?
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. Got to send some love out here to the Sewing and Quilting Center in St. George, Utah. This would be Teresa and Eric Alsop. They are the current owners of this wonderful business established back in 1984. And if you are into sewing at any level, even if you're just sewing curious, you know, you just want to see what it's all about. First of all, it's a very viable pastime and hobby. And the people who do it very well, and they take it quite seriously. You wouldn't believe the tools that are available, whether it's sewing machines, sergers, long arm quilting, and so forth. It's all there in one place. And something I really like about Sewing and Quilting Center is when you buy a machine from them, you not only get the machine, but you also get classes on how to use that machine. And those classes never expire. Every machine comes with free classes on how to use it. You could come back and take the class again if you forget or if you just want a refresher course. They service what they sell. I mean, you could be set for a long time if you purchase your sewing and quilting and embroidery machines through sewingquiltingcenter.com. And they also have classes to teach you how to make the most of those machines, and they have the fabric and the threads and everything you need. Reach out to them and tell them thanks for being a sponsor of this show. They'll appreciate hearing from you, and I will definitely appreciate you making the case that their message is reaching your ears. So when people in power do genuinely destructive things with their power, we have a prime opportunity to learn from their mistakes. And now we also have a duty that goes along with that to ensure that the people who made those kind of mistakes are not allowed to wield such power ever again. Got a great article here from J.B. Shirk, published on AmericanThinker.com. After COVID, never again. He says, 2 years ago, how many people would have predicted that tennis's number one ranked player would be banned from competing in Australia and France for refusing to allow their governments to decide what's injected into his body? How many people would have predicted the construction of internment camps to house citizens who similarly refused to comply? How many would have predicted that national leaders of democratic countries, democratic in quotation marks, would demand censorship of dissenting points of view? How many would have predicted that tech and media companies would eagerly jump at those calls for censorship by actively deleting from the public square any voices contrary to the official narratives sanctioned by those in power? Now, he's not just pulling examples out of thin air. He actually links to examples of everything he's just mentioned. Well, J.B. Shirk says, whatever threat to human health the China virus poses, it has been dwarfed by the threats to peace, stability, and freedom caused by 2 years of government tyranny run amok. For people who either never experienced the authoritarianism practiced by dictatorships abroad, or who stubbornly believed that the leaders of free nations would somehow be immune to the corrupting influence of power, these 2 years have hopefully been a wake-up call. And he says, if and when we ever get on the other side of this COVID-1984 war against citizens, never again must take on a new additional meaning that includes people's resolute promise never to allow their governments to embrace totalitarianism in the names of health and security. He says, take this shameful moment in the history of nation states once committed to liberty and use it to advantage by teaching your children and your grandchildren how quickly freedom can be smothered by politicians and bureaucrats with the best of intentions. Now, J.B. Shirk says all of this leads to a damning question. Why have so few people with power stood up during these past 2 years to call out this COVID-1984 madness for what it is? The greatest and most organized attack on human freedom in nearly a century. Yes, voices have been censored in ways once unthinkable in the West. Sure, companies have worked hand in glove with governments to intimidate, punish, and mock dissenters. It's true that part of the reason for the success of Wu Flu totalitarianism is that a large portion of the population actually clamored for governments to strip them of their rights and dominate their lives in a bargain for personal survival, as short-sighted as any ever made with the devil. Now, what's sometimes overlooked, however, is that no system created by humans is capable of protecting freedom without constant pushback from the humans or the people whose freedom is at stake. Even people still in possession of some lingering virtue find it difficult to sustain a sense of right and wrong in the halls of government. Political bureaucracy, by its nature, drains morality from its workforce. Human life is reduced to just numbers. But J.B. Shirk says every human life matters. The problem is that government work teaches the opposite lesson. Life is just a numbers game. Consider a small-town mayor in rural America. Far from the swamp in D.C., that official is still forced to make decisions that statistically will lead to someone's death. Perhaps the choice of how to spend limited local tax dollars is between adding a traffic light and celebrating the harvest in the public square. So choosing the latter may one day lead to an unnecessary automobile death, while choosing the former may diminish the mayor's re-election hopes. Government actors learn quickly that small decisions have unintended life or death consequences. Once human life is seen as nothing more than a number, though, most political actors find it easier to bury their consciences beneath statistics. What kind of a monster would trap people in their homes, close their churches, and deprive them of any means of making a living? Well, for some of those monsters, case totals and transmission rates outweighed the reason, rationality, or restraint required to protect human rights during a potential emergency. Treating humans as numbers justified trampling on the Constitution and Bill of Rights. And the result of that short-sightedness has been devastating. Then there's the conspiracy of silence. Imagine a serial murder preying on a community. Both the mayor and chief of police are determined to protect their jurisdiction. Officers arrest a suspect who seems guilty. A jury convicts and the murders stop. Then, years later, it's discovered by an investigator that a piece of evidence was illegally planted on the suspect and that the man in prison may not be guilty. What happens? Well, for moral people, the answer is simple. You bring up evidence of impropriety, you bring it forward to ensure that justice is done. However, in practice, such a disclosure would end up damaging both the police force and the civilian political authorities, as well as weaken the public's sense of safety. So too often, a conspiracy of silence develops where the very people vested with the power to punish crimes end up becoming after-the-fact accessories to those crimes in a type of wicked feedback loop. Good intentions are protected with silence even after they've proven to have caused tremendous harm. Now think of everyone in the U.S. government who must have known that the emergency use vaccines developed to combat the China virus would injure or kill a percentage of those treated, yet chose not to inform the public. Think of all the doctors denying simple therapeutics to patients. Think of all the hospitals fraudulently listing unrelated causes of death as from COVID instead of with COVID in order to recoup higher payouts from the federal government. Think of all the medical journals that have censored research contradicting the official COVID narrative. And again, he's not pulling these examples out of thin air. He's backing them up with links that will show you what he's talking about. J.B. Shirk says any one of these institutional guardians would have benefited the public by providing greater transparency, but they chose instead to protect the reputations of government actors, medical luminaries, even science itself, by staying silent. So when the ends justify the means, and ethics are supplanted with good intentions, unfathomably large numbers of people can conspire to commit crimes against humanity without ever having to say a word. Now, there's more to this article. We're going to come back to it here in just a few moments, but I'll remind you, I have a link to this in the show notes at thebrianhydeshow.com. I don't expect you to agree with all of this. I understand if some of this is possibly pushing buttons, or at least pushing you up against the boundaries of your moral and your mental universe. My goal isn't to make you mad. It's not to prove how smart I am because I found this article and shared it with you. I just want to introduce to you some of the ideas that are out there that I think accurately reflect the reality of what we're facing. I think this is one. Ultimately, you get to decide, though, whether it is or not.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. I've been sharing an article here from J.B. Shirk from AmericanThinker.com. After COVID-19 84, never again. And I don't know if there's a way I can really convey how righteously ticked off I have been at times over the last couple of years, watching people in authority abuse that authority and cling to anything that will further their power, not realizing how much, or not acknowledging, I should say, how much damage their policies were doing. And right now there's a big scramble on the part of a lot of those people who are making those decisions to try to get ahead of the narrative. Well, you know, I always said, you know, we shouldn't force people to do this kind of stuff, as they're looking around to see if anybody's, you know, going to call them on it. That's pretty cowardly. And it's not like there haven't been plenty of voices speaking up, you know, every step of the way. How do I know? Because I'm one of them. I'm one of many voices that have spoken up. And all those things that were dismissed as, well, that's just kooky conspiracy theory and, you know, only a nut job would ever believe that. How many of those things turned out to hold water? Maybe masks aren't all that when it comes to protecting people. Maybe these vaccines are being rushed and there are some unintended consequences that should be considered first. Maybe government shouldn't be telling who's essential and who isn't essential. Maybe they shouldn't be borrowing trillions of dollars and sending it out like they're dropping it from a helicopter over the masses. Yeah, there have been plenty of voices that have warned about this. So why again? Why is it that the people in power have fallen prey to the idea that, but we had to do something, and, you know, even if it was the worst thing, at least we were doing something? The last point that J.B. Shirk makes in his article is there's the allure of propaganda. The first lesson, he says, is that politicians learn is slogans work. Unfortunately, this lesson teaches them that propaganda is more important than objective truth. Repetition of certain selected words becomes more valuable than complex nuance. Successful repetition of lies proves that some people are more willing to be led astray. Routinely successful manipulation of a population eventually convinces political actors that people are nothing but sheep to be controlled. People become things not worthy of individual respect, and when that happens, propaganda flows from the government without remorse. Those with power justify these deceits as noble lies. Well, when one noble lie is followed by another and another, nobody even asks what is right or wrong. Instead, the question is asked whether those lies will succeed in obtaining public compliance. I don't know why, but that makes me think about Dr. Fauci for some reason. Anyway, back to the article. Or whether those with power today will retain power tomorrow. Or whether the policies of COVID-1984 further the great reset goals of global government. Memes and sound bites replace concern for truth. And the end effect is rampant nihilism among those with power. Human life becomes insignificant next to the self-interest of government actors. The natural rights and liberties of any individual become undermined and forgotten. And those who choose to defy regime-enforcing propaganda become domestic enemies. So J.B. Shirk says what 2 years of COVID-1984 should have taught people by now is that bureaucracies can never be trusted to police themselves for our protection. When the powerful treat the powerless as meaningless statistics to be manipulated and kept in the dark, then it's up to the powerless to determine how much tyranny they're willing to endure before finally deciding they've had enough. I mean, it all comes back to the question of consent. That's something that you and I need to have absolutely crystal clear in our minds. Is at what point we should withdraw our consent. That really strikes fear into the heart of many politicians, because withdrawing that consent doesn't just mean I'm not going to vote for you. It means I'm not going to obey you. You know, when enough people show up, for instance, not wearing a mask in a place where there's mask mandates, what are they going to do? They're going to arrest everybody? They can't. I don't know what your line in the sand is, but I suggest that it's something you should understand very clearly. I thought I knew what my line in the sand was, and the harder people pushed, the more my line in the sand came to resemble an entrenchment. It's fortified, man. That line ain't moving. Anyhow, moving on. I want to share something with you from Kent McManigal. I love Kent's ability to get to the heart of the matter and his recent essay on how modern life isn't a gift from government. Does such a great job. This is such a succinct reminder not to let politicians try to convince you otherwise. Kent McManigal says the conveniences of the modern world are all around us all the time, but I don't think I'll ever take them for granted. He says one of my grandmothers grew up in this area. I believe he lives in New Mexico during the Dust Bowl days. Her big family was crowded into a two-room, dirt-floored shack without indoor plumbing or electricity. They traveled by horse-drawn wagon. Their water was dipped from a cistern. They didn't even have a windmill. They picked cotton by hand, dragging the heavy sacks behind them. She grew up basically living the same life as someone born in this region 100 years earlier could have lived. Now, the Great Depression didn't even affect her family. At least it never figured into any of the stories she told about growing up. He says, when I was a kid, the old shack was still standing, and I visited it with her a couple of times. Now, their life wasn't easy, but it was good enough. So maybe it's understandable that I can still marvel at things like indoor plumbing with running water and flush toilets and electricity. It's not as though I've ever had to live without those things. But he says, I realize how few of the people who have ever been alive had them. Now, that's a sobering thought. If you're feeling poor me, man, I could only get one of my 5 cars to start today. Hey, that's a first world problem right there. You won the lottery simply being born, in an English-speaking country, for starters, let alone being born in the U.S. Ken McManigal says, anything that's been around such a short time can go away easier than you suppose. There's little chance they'll go away in our lifetime, but he says over the long term, the chances are fairly high. If something happens, these modern conveniences go away, the radical socialists who use the environment as their excuse would quickly realize how bad this would be for the environment. But he says, truthfully, I think they already know. They just don't care as long as it kills off most humans. Now, Kent McManigal says, I'm not content to be dependent on modern conveniences. I enjoy making fire without lighters or matches, but the ability to make fire with primitive methods makes me value the ease of using a lighter even more highly. It's the same with every skill. And he says, I'm grateful to all the researchers, experimenters, and workers who've given us the good things of the modern world. Some others would also like credit. But here's the key. Government would like you to believe it brought about this modern world's peace, prosperity, and safety. Yet the truth is, when these things are the norm, it's usually in spite of political government, not because of it. So appreciate the heroes and not the freeloaders. He's got a good point here. Most of the things that you and I enjoy, the things that make our lives better, did not come about because some benevolent politician thought, if I could just harness enough tax money and enough effort on the part of this army of bureaucrats, why, we could make people's lives so much better. I know they want to take credit. I mean, right? They want us to believe the sun would not rise this morning if it weren't for the benevolent and steady leadership of our President Joe Biden. Now, you and I probably know better. I'm still a big fan of the idea of agorism, the idea of reducing your governmental footprint. Ideally, I would love to see the point come where, you know, my contact with the federal government particularly only happens when I choose to walk into a post office and drop a letter in this slot. Other than that, I'd pretty much just like to be left alone to sort out my own way and my own pursuit of happiness. I know, doesn't that sound like extremist rhetoric? That sound like, you know, something a really crazy person would say? What? You're rejecting the blessings of the political class? How could you do this, citizen? What's wrong with you? Well, what's wrong with me is my pronouns are currently awake and concerned. That's what's wrong with me. I see the direction that we are being taken. I see the pleas for government to be in charge of ever more areas of our lives and to provide oversight and direction, which always comes in the form of some kind of mandate or enforcement. And I'm just not down with it. Now, I'll concede there are some aspects of civil government that can be a blessing when they are limited to their proper role of guaranteeing people's rights, seeing that justice prevails, making people whole after they have been victimized, measurably victimized. But a lot of it today just comes down to, well, some bureaucrat says this, so I guess you have to do it. We can live very comfortably with a lot less government than we currently live with. We just have to be in the habit of being problem solvers. But you'd be surprised how many problems can be solved by people who are willing to, you know, voluntarily cooperate. And that's not such a hard thing to achieve.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. Just want to give a quick shout out here to the Heather Turner team at Patriot Home Mortgage in St. George, Utah. Her office is located at 619 South Bluff Street. If you want to call her, you can call 435-703-4522. Now, there are a lot of people who have been fleeing from various parts of the country and coming to various red states. Utah is one of the big ones. I think it's in the top 10 or close to it of most traveled to states or most moved to states. I mean, it's crazy. And I've seen similar things happening here in Idaho. But specifically for my listeners in Utah, if you find yourself looking for a home mortgage, you need to talk to Heather Turner and her team at Patriot Home Mortgage. Her NMLS ID is 715386. Patriot Home Mortgage is an equal housing opportunity lender. Heather has the experience and the know-how and the clout to get you the loan you need and to get it quickly, which in a very competitive real estate market, well, that really matters. You'll also find a link to her email in my show notes at thebrianhydeshow.com. So I've been beating the drum a little bit about January 6th, mainly because we just went past the first anniversary of it. And of course, it's a cow that's still being milked for all the outrage they can get out of it by members of the political class. And I want to make really clear, you do not have to be any type of supporter of the January 6th protesters, including those who let themselves into the Capitol, to be appalled at how the official explanation of what happened just isn't adding up. I've got a great article here from John Green about the January 6th narrative is starting to unravel. And I beat this drum simply because it has been, the narrative has been weaponized and is being used as a way to paint patriotic Americans like you and me, some many of whom were not even anywhere near Washington, D.C., but we are being painted as domestic enemies, domestic terrorists, extremists that are a threat to our democracy. It's important that somebody speak out against this propaganda. Now, John Green says, the Democrats and propaganda ministry have tried to portray the events of January 6th as the greatest assault on democracy in, like, forever. But it seems that the narrative is starting to unravel. The unraveling began when many people began to suspect the whole thing was a setup and started looking into it. And it wasn't law enforcement or mainstream media journalists investigating. They could be controlled. It was amateur citizen investigators using the power of the Internet. Ah, the Internet. Allowing average citizens to cross-reference and collate a limitless sea of information. John Green says our founders would approve. Citizen investigators begin to identify individuals who were clearly involved in inciting the riot on January 6th, but a curious number of them had not been arrested by the FBI, even though their identity was well known. One such individual is Ray Epps. Epps is seen on video urging the crowd to enter the Capitol building. Now, he lives in Arizona on a ranch and hasn't been arrested, and there are numerous others just like him. So the question became unavoidable. Did the federal government have involvement with January 6th? Well, we don't know the answer to that question. And that's a problem for a constitutional republic. John Green says as this curious information began to come to public attention, the FBI cover-up started. First of all, it removed Ray Epps from its most wanted list and released a report stating there was no evidence of a coordinated attack on the Capitol, even though they'd been calling it a coordinated attack for months. Apparently, the Bureau hoped the whole thing would fade into obscurity, but it didn't. Merrick Garland and San Fran Nan, see, wouldn't let it. So the proud head of the police part of our police state couldn't let it go. Garland was having too much fun playing with his new fully operational Death Star, which has the Orwellian name Department of Justice. Garland, the only thing that's been missing, by the way, is a Peoples at the beginning of that name. Unfortunately, Garland has bragged for months about his shock and awe campaign to bring insurrectionists to justice. So the DOJ has had hundreds of citizens under arrest for months for the horrendous crimes of trespassing and taking selfies on Capitol grounds. What are prosecutors supposed to do? Go to the judge and say, oops, our bad. No, that's not the way police states operate. And Merrick Garland isn't the only one pushing the narrative beyond what the evidence supports. Nancy Pelosi's kept the topic in the news as well. She's facing a midterm shellacking, looking down the barrel of a Trump return to politics, and she needs a propaganda blunt object with which to beat on Republicans. Her solution was simple, elegant, and stupid. Appoint a committee to investigate something that didn't happen, the greatest assault on our democracy since Pearl Harbor, or was it 9/11? I forget. Add a couple of useful idiot Republicans, preferably of the never Trump variety. Subpoena every Republican in the known universe and provide creative leaks to the awaiting propaganda ministry. Pelosi, note to self, don't forget to add Adam Schiff to the committee. Voila! A year's worth of negative Trump news cycles. Maybe it could even be stretched to 3 years, but after a year of investigating an insurrection that the FBI said wasn't an insurrection, the question started to get a bit too inconvenient for San Fran Nan's committee. So she did what masters do. She jerked the leash hard and her twin dogs barked. The committee released a statement defending Ray Epps. And the FBI arrested Stuart Rhodes, the leader of Oath Keepers, and a number of his fellow travelers. Now, in August of 2021, the FBI said there was no evidence of a coordinated attack on the Capitol. Now, in January of 2020, the FBI is saying that Stuart Rhodes organized teams to conduct an armed paramilitary operation to prevent congressional certification of the vote. There's just one problem. It never happened. Except for the activities of Ray Epps, who is no longer wanted by the FBI, there was no coordination at all of the mob at the Capitol. Stuart Rhodes was present, but he never entered the Capitol, and like the other Oath Keepers present, he was unarmed. In fact, the only firearms present in the Capitol on that day were those in the possession of the Capitol Police, one of which was used to kill an unarmed protester. Now, the indictment of the Oath Keepers is not about what they did. It's about what they wanted to do, even though they didn't do it. See, crimes of intent are tricky things to prosecute. How can any man know what's in another man's heart and mind? Does the FBI have some evidence of his actual desire, or is Stuart Rhodes automatically guilty of wrongthink because he's patriotic, you know, an anti-government conservative? Maybe the FBI's gotten possession of incriminating emails. It's possible that Rhodes, a Yale-trained lawyer, blasted out his insurrection plans with his Gmail account. Of course, the jury will also need to consider the FBI history of falsifying emails, such as it did to get warrants against Carter Page. Maybe the FBI has witnesses that overheard the Oath Keepers' plans. The Bureau's well known for planting informants in organizations suspected of subversion. But whatever witnesses it has had better have more credibility than Andrew McCabe or Peter Stroke or Kevin Kleinsmith or any of the three agents that have been removed from the Whitmer kidnapping witness list. Now, John Green says, I'm not jumping to any conclusions about the Oath Keepers. Whatever evidence the FBI has is going to need very close examination by an army of citizen investigators. And he says, don't underestimate their abilities. It didn't work out so well for Dan, fake but accurate, rather. Much to the FBI's consternation, the January 6th investigation hasn't faded, and the amateur investigations continue. And the questions are getting more inconvenient by the nanosecond. Now we have an attorney general and various FBI officials who can do little more than stammer and mutter the words, ongoing investigation, and stare at the ceiling while being questioned by Congress. Ongoing investigation is starting to feel like the new pleading the fifth. Now, John Green says after the Republicans win the midterm elections, they should keep the January 6th committee in place, but under new management. San Fran Nan's committee set a few precedents that should be very useful. The minority party has no rights. Committee members are subject to the approval of the Speaker of the House. Executive privilege is a thing of the past. Any member of the opposing party is also fair game. Republicans should also subpoena Merrick Garland, Christopher Wray, and Nancy Pelosi. John Green says, I'm dying to see how Granny Boxwine does under questioning from Ted Cruz. Watching Cackles Harris laugh nervously at every question should just about end her political future, if she hasn't already ended it herself. Heck, he says, they should even subpoena the electronic devices of Shifty Schiff and Bang Bang the Fang Fang Swalwell. I'm sure they have some interesting texts and emails about January 6th as well. Dang. John Green does not hold back on this. I don't know for sure, you know, what I haven't handled the evidence, neither have you. I mean, we know what comes to us from various sources, but I do know that the official version really doesn't add up. And the fact that officials who are asked very pointed questions like what kind of involvement was there by federal agencies in the events of January 6th? You know, if the truth was on the side of the government and they could clearly say, look, there was none, let it go. That would be one thing. But all this hemming and hawing, and well, I can't comment on that. I cannot comment on that. It doesn't seem to lend itself towards, well, I think they're really being honest. It looks more like they have something to hide.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.